So I want to conclude this evening with just a few words on the sevenfold puja. As its name suggests and implies, it consists of seven parts. And these parts represent, as it were, a sequence of devotional moods and attitudes, accompanied, where necessary, with appropriate ritual actions. First of all, puja, or worship. This consists in the making of offerings. This is its essential feature. And in its simplest form, the making of offerings consists simply of offering flowers, lights, whether lighted candles or lamps, and sticks of burning incense. There are other offerings also, such as what are known as the seven ordinary offerings, consisting of water for drinking, water for washing the feet, flowers, incense, light, perfume, food, and sometimes also, eighthly, music. These are, incidentally, the ancient Indian offerings to the honored guest. In fact, even today in India, if you visit anyone's house as an honored guest, they'll at once give you a glass of water to drink, because it's very hot usually in India and you're thirsty. And then they'll give you water for washing the feet. Very often they'll come and wash your feet themselves, especially if you're a monk. Because you've come over the dusty roads of India, your feet are dirty, so they have to be washed. And then, after that, they present you with a garland of flowers, as you must have seen in some of our slides. Whenever we had a Buddhist meeting, or whenever we went to a Buddhist meeting among the ex-untouchables, a garland of flowers was offered. And then they light incense sticks to create a pleasant atmosphere, keep away flies and mosquitoes, then light a lamp, especially if it's evening time, then they offer perfume, to sprinkle the body with, and of course a meal, food, and sometimes after the food a little music. So this is the way in India you entertain an honored guest. So these seven or eight offerings to the honored guest become in Buddhism the seven or eight religious offerings, and they're offered to the Buddha because the Buddha comes, as it were, as a guest into the world. He represents an eruption into the world from some higher plane. He represents in this mundane world something transcendental, so he's a sort of guest, so he's treated and honored as a sort of guest, and the offerings therefore assume these forms. Now sometimes the seven or eight offerings are offered in kind on the altar. You've actually got water and perfume and flowers and incense and food, but more often, especially in Tibet, instead of the seven or eight offerings in kind, they have seven bowls of water, just as we have on our own shrine here this evening. And this is what they represent, the seven or eight offerings to the honored guest, the Buddha himself being conceived of in that way. So this is puja, or worship, the making of offerings. And then secondly, vandana, which means obeisance or salutation. And this consists in paying respect with the body, showing your respect in a bodily manner. Some people say it's enough to keep it all in the mind. They say it's enough to feel respect, to feel reverence for the Buddha in the mind. Now this is true, but if you feel it strongly enough, you want to express it externally. If you like someone, you don't want to keep it all in your mind. You express it externally. First, you're a totality. You're not just mind, you're body and speech too. So if you feel true veneration for the Buddha, you won't want just to keep it within the mind. You'll spontaneously express it with your body, with your hands. So there are many forms of vandana or obeisance, from just joining the hands in salutation as we do when we chant the puja, to the full prostration going right down on the floor, which is done on ceremonial occasions. But whether we just put the hands together or just touch the fingertips together, or whether we go right down on the floor full length, all these things, all these attitudes represent a humble and receptive attitude on our part, express our openness to the spiritual inspiration coming from the Buddha. And then thirdly, going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, which of course marks a sort of turning point in our spiritual life, represent a sort of committing of ourselves, taking the Buddha as the spiritual ideal, the Dharma as the way to realize that, the Sangha as the community of those in whose company we shall realize that ideal. Going for refuge represents, we may say, a total orientation of our whole life. Formal taking of the refuges, or formal going for refuge, is done by repeating them after a senior monk, plus certain silas or precepts, and this makes one what we call an upasaka, a lay brother or lay sister, which is the first grade or first level of the Buddhist order. And we hope ourselves, the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, to arrange fairly shortly for the first ordinations under our auspices to this level or this grade of the Buddhist order, lay brother or lay sister who goes for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. Then fourthly, confession of faults. This is very important in all forms of Buddhism. Its significance is psychological rather than theological. Many people we know suffer from repressed feelings of guilt. And because of these repressed feelings of guilt, leading very often to self-hatred, they cannot develop love or maitri, at least not in its fullness. Now, Buddhist monks, if they're conscious of any fault or shortcoming, confess among themselves, especially to their own teacher, their own guru. The lay people confess to their own guru or to the Buddha. Not only confess, but it is the custom, if one is conscious of any fault or shortcoming, to burn incense in front of the image of the Buddha and recite sutras, and to go on doing this until you feel free from the sense of guilt. This is very important psychologically. But it is pointed out that these practices do not absolve one from the consequences of the fault you've committed. You have to bear, you have to suffer the consequences, but you are free subjectively from the feeling of remorse and guilt. And that is very important, because sometimes it poisons or vitiates one's whole spiritual life. So, confession of faults. Fifthly, rejoicing in merit. This is complementary to the previous practice. If you think about your faults, if you contemplate your shortcomings and numerous backslidings too much or too often, you may become a bit downhearted, a bit disheartened. So you should inspire yourself after that by recollecting the virtues of others. Thinking of the Buddhas, thinking of the Bodhisattvas, thinking of the lives they have led, thinking of the perfections which they have practiced. Think, say, of Milarepa, his inspiring example. Think of Hui Ning. Think of Han Shan. Think of Hakuin. Think, if you like, of various secular heroes and heroines of lives whose lives have been an inspiration, who lived for the benefit of others. People like Florence Nightingale or Elizabeth Fry. Great humanitarians, great social reformers, and so on. And think even of the virtues of ordinary people. Just think over all your friends. Think sometimes how well they do act, how unselfish, how kind they are on occasions. And dwell on this side of their natures. And in this way, learn to appreciate, learn to rejoice in the merits of all other living beings, from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas right down to ordinary people who happen to be your friends and neighbours. And this will give you a feeling of exhilaration, a feeling of, as it were, support, that you're not alone in the world, spiritually speaking. You're treading the same path that others have tread, that others are treading successfully. And you'll feel buoyed up, as it were, in your own spiritual life, your own spiritual endeavor. Then sixthly, entreaty and supplication. Now, this is based on an episode in the Buddha's life, according to legend, when after his enlightenment, Brahma Sahampati, a certain deity, appeared before him and requested him to preach out of compassion for all living beings, to make known the truth he had discovered. Now, we must understand the significance of this. It doesn't mean that the Buddha has to be reminded of what he has to do. The Buddha didn't really need Brahma Sahampati to come and tell him or advise him that he ought to preach. What it signifies, this episode and this part of the puja, is that the disciple must be ready. The disciple must really want the teaching, must entreat, as it were, the teacher, the Buddha, to give the teaching. It's said sometimes that when the disciple is ready, the master will appear. So this particular part of the puja, this episode, represents that readiness and that willingness to receive the teaching. Now, seventhly and lastly, the transference or dedication of merits and self-surrender. This consists in wishing or aspiring that whatever merit, whatever benefit one has gained or derived from celebrating this sevenfold puja or any other religious act, whether it's observing the precepts, going for refuge, studying Buddhist philosophy, practicing meditation, it means one wants to share the benefits of that with all other living beings. One isn't concerned just with one's own salvation. One hasn't just got one's own nirvana for one's own sake. One wants to gather up, as it were, the whole of humanity, all living beings, and help them also contribute to their evolution in the direction of the goal of nirvana. There's no religious individualism. When you practice any religious exercise, you should feel, as it were, that all other living beings are practicing with you. There's a particular exercise in the Mahayana for this. When you do a religious exercise, you should feel, you should visualize that everybody else is doing it with you and sharing in the benefits with you. If you sit to meditate, think everybody else is meditating. When you chant the Buddha's praises, think everybody else is chanting. When you recite a mantra, think everybody else is reciting. And in this way, have the feeling of sharing whatever benefits you derive from your own spiritual exercises with all other people. And this, of course, paves the way for what we call the Bodhisattva vow. The vow whereby one takes upon oneself a resolution that one will not gain enlightenment for one's own self, one's own sake only, but that one will take with one, carry with one, all living beings whatsoever, so that all enter enlightenment, all gain nirvana, all achieve supreme Buddhahood. So this is the sevenfold puja, a sequence, a very beautiful sequence of emotional, devotional attitudes, to which we give expression in appropriate forms of words, as you will hear later on this evening, if you care to stay and participate in our sevenfold puja when we celebrate it. On special occasions, the sevenfold puja can be celebrated on a very grand scale, as it were, with magnificent offerings and so on. But for daily use, we have a simplified version, and so far as we're concerned in our public meetings and meetings among ourselves, we follow a middle way. We don't have anything very grand, at the same time, it's not as starkly simple as it might be if we were doing it just on our own.